Hello and welcome to Said Contra, a podcast of the Soccer Doctrina Project. My name is Dr. Brandon Wanless. I am one of the co-founders of the Soccer Doctrina Project. I teach dogmatic theology at the St. Paul Seminary at the University of St. Thomas. And I'm joined today by Molly Eggelsrud. She's a doctoral candidate in moral theology and teaching fellow at CUA. Molly, can you say hi?
Hi, Brandon. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast.
And we also have Father John Wilson, who's a priest of the Archdiocese of New York and doctoral candidate in theology at the Angelicum and chaplain at Columbia University.
Hi, Brandon. Hey, Molly. Great to be here.
Well, thanks for joining. Today, we want to talk about the theological virtue of faith. In some ways, just an opportunity for us to make sense of what is faith. I think faith is a pretty generic term. That gets thrown around quite a bit in the world and can designate all sorts of different things. We use the word faith when it comes to kind of very natural things, our natural relationships. We believe certain people to be true. We have a certain fidelity within our, you know, marriages and whatnot. But when we use the word faith when it comes to the Catholic faith, I think there's a lot of confusion and a lot of misconceptions. And so I think we're going to just start by asking the general question, you know, what exactly is faith and why is faith a virtue and what is faith not? So Father, you want to just start with answering a couple of those questions.
Well, yeah, thank you, Brandon. And I think it's really quite simple. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. Hebrews 11:1. I think we can end the podcast right now. Which is actually, it's interesting, Thomas Aquinas takes that verse as a full definition of the virtue. And I suppose we'll get to that, but he only gets there in question 4 of the Treatise on Faith and the Secunda Secundae. So we should probably, you know, taking St. Thomas as our teacher, as at least I would propose that we do, should follow his order of elaboration, because he deals with faith in questions 1 through 16 of the Secunda Secundae, often called the Treatise on Faith, and the entire structure of the Secunda Secundae is, you know, by the virtues, you know, first the three theological virtues, and then the moral cardinal virtues and their allied virtues and whatnot. So we would be walking through the Secunda Secundae, at least the first parts. But then, of course, in the Prima Secundae, he is talking about the moral life in general and answers questions such as, you know, what is a virtue in the first place? And there he talks about how in the Christian life, in the supernatural life, these three theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity, which are the core of how we relate to God. And they are the beginning of the supernatural life precisely because they give to the believer his or her end, which is beatitude. That faith presents to the intellect God as first truth. Hope presents to the will God as beatifying, God as good for me. And then charity presents to the will God as good, God as fully lovable in himself. And so we speak of the theological virtues as the virtues that are unique in that they have God as their object. And when, you know, when Thomas starts to talk about faith in the Secunda Secundae, that's where he starts. He says, okay, what is the object of faith? And that's a big, big word that we should spend some time unpacking, but I'm going to stop there for now.
Yeah. It's funny, actually, Father John, that you bring up that we don't get what is faith until question four. So basically like halfway through Thomas's treatise in the Summa. In his earlier treatments, in the sentences, and then also in the De Veritate, he starts with what is faith, but then for the Summa, starts with the formal object. And this is something I think the Thomist tradition has picked up on as a central insight of Aquinas, that really what makes faith what it is, what makes it special, what helps us answer so many of the questions people have about faith, is that the formal object is God himself. Sometimes, especially in the Middle Ages, there was this perceived conflict between the enunciable truths about God and God himself. But for Thomas, there's really no dichotomy, because we believe God because God tells us about himself, reveals himself in the articles of faith, which are enunciable. Romana Cesario has a beautiful way of putting this, in that it's a sort of merciful appropriation of God himself to the human intellect to have articles of faith. And those participate in God himself. So there's no need to draw kind of false distinctions between God and what we know about God in the articles.
Maybe we can just take a quick second to explain what is meant by object. Father, you mentioned that it's a big term, and I think you're right. And I know Molly, we've talked about this as well. What, either of you can take this, but what do we mean by object when we're talking about a virtue having an object?
Well, so I would go right back to quoting Father Romano Cesario as well. He has a great book on faith, and you know, dives right into this question, and he takes object as it at its simplest and at its most comprehensive, and he says an object is any reality capable of perfecting a person through engagement with itself. So, you know, a human act, you know, perfects the human person through some kind of engagement with an exterior reality. And that reality is the object, the in Latin, objectum, the thing you're throwing yourself against. And this is an insight, like the way, I guess, in the Summa, as Molly was pointing out, not so much in the earlier works, but in the Summa, this is actually an insight that Aquinas takes to his moral theology as a whole, where he starts with the object of each virtue, because it's the object that specifies the act. It's the object that makes the act what it is, the object that, you know, enables you to say distinctly what it is that you are doing. And of course, it's the act that specifies the virtue. The virtue is the habit of, you know, performing that act well and with ease and with delight. So the object is any reality capable of perfecting a person through engagement with itself. And what's really important about the object of faith, hope, and charity is that this is an insight I picked up from T.C. O'Brien in his great little introduction to the treatise on faith. Really, it's only as an object of human act that God can be more present to the soul, to the human soul, than he is to the rest of his creation. We say God is everywhere by his power, by his knowledge. How is it that he is more present to me than that? Well, it's because I know him, I love him through these supernatural virtues that he's given me. So that's why it's so important that the object of faith, hope, and charity is God. And within that term object, there are a number of really important distinctions to make that Aquinas himself makes right in question one of the Secunda Secundae, but I'll stop there.
Well, look, before we get into that, just a quick, if I can maybe summarize or clarify, or ask for if this is clarifying. So if faith is a kind of knowing, yep, right? We talk about an object of knowledge, or some, basically, what is the object of my knowing? But I know something, right? I have knowledge of something. And so if faith is a type of knowing, we talk about the object of faith. It's saying, okay, when I have faith, I know something, right? Because faith is a virtue that perfects the intellect, my intellect. And so what am I knowing? Like you said, all the theological virtues have their object in God. And so I'm knowing God. Is that as simple as it can be in a way?
Molly, you got this one?
You just know God, Brandon. It's easy.
don't you just feel him?
You just feel in your heart. It's, you know, no. Let me know if this helps answer your question. There's a distinction between knowing things about God that could be known naturally. So we can talk about natural arguments, just looking at motion, looking at teleology, that we can know the existence of a God. But what the theological virtues do is put us in touch with God himself. And in faith, it's God as first truth. I don't know. I don't want to steal your thunder, Father John, because I know you were really excited about the different sorts of formal object and associated with faith. But maybe it helps to give the kind of classic example of, like, if you have an apple, the formality of sight, that the formal object of the apple as an object of sight is its color. So it's red. And then there's a mediating formal object, light, that is that by which you know the color of it. So in the case of faith, the formal object is God himself as first truth. And the mediating formal object is God as first truth revealing himself. Where if you have just natural knowledge of God, you know it from natural things. And it's not God revealing himself supernaturally to your intellect. Sorry, I didn't mean to steal your thunder. Father John was very excited on Slack earlier about all the different types of formal object.
No, I think we can still get into that. I think that's very helpful, Molly. But it seems to confirm my thought or my question, that it is a type of knowing, and we are knowing God, where our intellects are getting in touch with God, as you said, but it's not merely, God as a certain kind of material object, right? As just something known, but I know God in a kind of direct way, and that it's supernatural, right? So that it's not merely, me knowing God, knowing something about God, or knowing that there is a God or something. All those things are important, of course, and those things are accessible to us, both naturally and supernaturally. But this is a supernatural knowing that where the mind touches God in a way.
Yes, yeah. Through the motion of grace. Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Father John, you're about to say.
Yeah, Father, do you want to speak a little bit to the distinction that Aquinas will first make when it comes to that God as object or the object of faith?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. And to kind of pick apart, I think, the two aspects of your question there, Brandon. So we have, as Molly was saying, you know, things we can know about God through natural reason, which are, you know, to the extent that we know them through natural reason, like not the object of faith. This is God as not object of faith. And why? Because the mediation of that knowledge, the thing that gets me access to it, the way in which it is the object of my intellect, is my own discovery through the use of my reason. So that's God as object of not faith, God as object of philosophy, God as object of science. But then, you know, faith, the object of faith, the thing that makes faith faith is that it's God revealing himself. It's things about God that I have access to because he says them. And that's what makes faith so supernatural and so important, so wonderful, is that it's a much more direct access to God because it's actually, it's a participation in God's own self-knowledge. It's part of how God divinizes us, because we, in our human way, in our human participation, in the way that we form judgments and receive truth, are seeing God in a sense as he sees himself. So what is the most formal aspect of the object of faith is God as first truth and God as first truth revealing. And because that is the, so, okay. When we talk about an object, you know, the most well-known distinction in objects is that we'll so often talk about a material object of something and a formal object of something. And that's really where Aquinas goes first in question one, article one, where he says, okay, the material object of the stuff that faith believes is anything that God reveals.
For right? example.
For example, that he is Trinity, that Abraham had two sons, that Jesus is fully God and fully man. And lots of different facts on different levels.
And I think this is often how we think about faith, right? We think about faith in terms of these material objects.
Right. The content, the stuff.
Right. I believe, I mean, this is what the creed is, right? We go through the creed and say, what is faith? Well, it's, I believe that in God, Father Almighty, et cetera.
Right. So that's, you could speak of that stuff as the material object of faith. And then the material aspect of the object, because the object is one. The formal aspect of the object is the thing that makes the object object. It's the thing that gives it its form, is the thing that constitutes it as what it is, i.e. object. And that is the mediation of God's own revelation. The fact that God is speaking it makes that stuff the object of my act of faith.
And Brandon, I think the other thing you're getting at is that we need God to make this act of faith. Faith is always a gift of grace. Is that kind of what you were getting at as well?
I'm just getting you to ask to say things. That's all.
But that's so true too, Molly. Right. And that's maybe worth dwelling on that it's.
But the point you're saying about the formal aspect of the object of faith, the one thing I often think about when it comes to Aquinas' treatise and how he utilizes this distinction is when he'll start talking about things like heresy. Right. And that sometimes it can be really hard, it seems, to tell the difference between someone who has true faith and someone who doesn't have true faith. And maybe, a particular Christian might not, be able to tell within themselves. And maybe this is a good way to examine the conscience a little bit. Do I believe because God has revealed and because God has made known and God is telling me and he's given this to the church, etc. Or am I believing, I just happen to think that X, Y, and Z are true, right? I just happen to think that God is Trinity, and it maybe has something to do with the Bible or something to do with, what the church teaches or something. Do you want to speak to a little bit of what makes the difference there and how this kind of formal aspect makes all the difference in all of that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that's a great example of why understanding that we have faith because of what God reveals is so important. Because it's not so much about, you have to check all these boxes to be a Catholic, or you have to check all these boxes not to be a heretic. But if you believe everything that God reveals, that's the whole of the Catholic faith. Whereas, say, another person, maybe who's just interested in reading more about this and finds a lot of logical reasons why the things the Catholic Church claims are true, are compelling. So say there's a lot of arguments for why the resurrection of Christ is pretty much the only reasonable outcome based on what we know. I think there's a whole book on it as well. And I know some people, that's kind of a first step, is that they see, just based on the evidence we have, that just is a reasonable explanation. But that's not faith. For faith, you believe God and what he reveals, and that's a whole. Whereas if you kind of need all these reasons from outside sources in order to believe something, then you don't have the whole of the virtue of faith. Does that make sense, Brandon?
Yeah, definitely. And it sounds like, the role of apologetics when it comes to faith is that it might help someone to come to faith in a way, but really because God has put it to use, it doesn't actually make one believe, right?
Exactly. Because the way Thomas puts it is that it can remove obstacles. So these arguments show that this is not impossible. And then the other portion of it is, in order to believe, it's usually not the case that it's like someone just wakes up one day and it's like, Jesus Christ is Lord. It's that they hear the preaching of the church and then are moved interiorly to believe. So we should never be afraid to make rational arguments to help people get rid of misconceptions. And the truth of the faith should always be preached, because basically you or I can't control who is going to believe, but God does use, especially preachers. I think this is probably a point very dear to St. Thomas as a member of the Order of Preachers, that does use the work of us in proclaiming the gospel to bring people to faith. So it's never in vain. But at the end of the day, there's always a matter of the heart to think, do I believe this because I believe God, or because I have all these rational reasons where I can somehow verify this? Or is it really a matter of my belief in God? And I don't know. I can't answer that question for anyone else.
Can I jump in on that?
Please.
Because I think this is, what we're actually talking, a helpful way to frame this would be to talk actually about the moment of conversion.
Yeah.
And this brings us back to your points, Molly and Brandon, about the importance of grace, how this really is from God. Because what you actually have as someone is on the precipice of faith is, right, he's heard the preaching of the church, he's made a judgment that this sounds right, that this is credible. And is almost perhaps, going to mass, almost considering himself a Catholic or just about, and I know these people, they're fun to watch. And because they're discovering truth and they're excited by the inquiry. And right up until the moment that faith is present, you actually have a different, it's God, they're knowing God under a different formality. They're under the formality of credibility. Like, okay, this, I'm making the judgment that this seems right. This coheres with what the evidence seems to suggest to my reason. And then when the gift of faith is given, like the formality of the judgment changes. And that's that, and because it's now, I believe because God has said so. And that scaffolding of argument can still be present in my mind, right? And can be very helpful for me to invite others to faith. But really it's just, that's what it is. It's scaffolding. And compared to the building of the supernatural virtue, it's actually much less solid because it depends on fallible human arguments. Whereas faith, once it's given, is on the authority of God revealing. And so you can actually notice that switchover at the moment of conversion.
So a couple things that I'm taking from this is that Although you're kind of making example of folks that you see kind of in their conversion, but it seems like you generally on the outside looking in can't necessarily tell if someone has faith that's animated by that grace and they're assenting to God because he has revealed himself, or they happen to believe, you know, many, if not all of the same things. It's maybe hard to believe that they would have all of the same things, but many of the same things, and, you know, seemingly be a card carrying Catholic, et cetera. But really are believing based on maybe their own private judgment in a certain respect, which is often how Aquinas will talk about heresy, right? So that, you know, heresy in the sense of I'm the one making a certain ultimate judgment that this is true, rather than just submitting my judgment to God's judgment or something. Again, that's not to go around thinking and suspecting that, oh man, most people don't actually have faith or something like that. But that's a real danger, I think, right? That we kind of start to analyze it in terms of what makes sense to me. The second thing that I seem to be taking from what you're saying, or what both of you are saying, is that apologetics is really worthwhile, but then evangelization definitely has a priority. And if we kind of invert that priority and exclusively or predominantly emphasize apologetics, it can almost give the impression that we believe these things on account of the kind of rational defenses that we're giving for our faith. And I think sometimes, or at least there was a time on the internet, it seemed that a lot of what Catholic engagement was apologetics, and trying to kind of give an account and a defense of the faith. And we don't want to, you know, discount apologetics, but we also don't want to kind of exclusively emphasize it. It makes it seem that we are believing these things because they make, fundamentally because they make rational sense to me.
Yeah. And I personally, I don't have many concerns about apologetics because, as Thomas puts it, once you believe and you love what you believe, you want more reasons to show why it's true. So as long as it's after you believe, someone who really wants to watch a bunch of YouTube videos on apologetics, that's actually a great thing. And then also just the reality is that especially in American culture, Catholics are a minority. And especially if you're in a more religious area of the country, like the South, most of the religious claims are fundamentally Protestant, and there's a lot of misconceptions about the Catholic faith. So I think there is actually a great need to break down a lot of those misunderstandings. And then also for people who just didn't receive a strong catechism to be strengthened by hearing reasons why their faith is correct, even in the face of other traditions. And then, you know, in places where I live in Washington, D.C., it can feel a little bit ridiculous to be religious when you walk around the streets of DC because it's a culture that's just really forgotten God. So for me, I see why a lot of people who are not, you know, studying theology full time, like all of us, are really drawn to hearing more reasons why the faith is correct.
So I think you're both right. And can I maybe try to synthesize a few things here? Because actually, firstly, Brandon, I want to push back a little bit on something you were
great
saying before.
Please.
So you're talking about, okay, well, the question is, okay, is our reason for believing still too human? And isn't this how Thomas describes heresy, right? That we've departed from the true formal object of faith, which is God's authority, and we're replacing it with our own private judgment. So yes, that is how Thomas describes heresy. And he's very, very clear. Question 5, Article 3, a heretic does not have faith for precisely this reason. That even though he might materially affirm most of the creed, the fact that he denies a single article of it, and you know, like, persistently denies, you know, culpably denies.
Presuming that they know that they're rejecting the teaching authority of the church or whatever.
because Thomas also distinguishes between error and heresy. You can be in error because you just are mistaken about what God has said and still have the supernatural virtue of faith, you know, and then, you know, be corrected. And but
sometimes we talk about this as material heresy versus formal heresy.
Right. And I think those distinctions can get into the weeds and maybe be applied to not exactly the right situations. But I think maybe the clearer distinction is between error and heresy. Because material and formal, as we were just talking before, can refer to a number of different cuts along the spectrum, right? Heresy, because I have rejected a single part of the creed and replaced it with what seems right to me, I've made a shipwreck of my faith. I don't have it anymore. But that's, I don't think that, except in strange situations when and sadly this does happen in some parts of the church and at some times where you're like awash in real dissent. Except for those situations, I don't think we should worry about, like, you know, looking at other Catholics and thinking, you know, in your heart of hearts, are you really a heretic because you like apologetics too much? Right. And this is where I would make a different distinction. Like, you can have true faith because you do in your mind, by the grace of God, affirm the creed for the right reason. Like, at the end of the day, you're okay with the idea, yes, I believe this because God has said it. But that faith that you truly do possess has maybe not yet conquered your normal pattern of thinking. And that's, I think, a big part of what it means to have weak faith.
So are you saying that different individuals can have various degrees of faith in a way, like a stronger faith, weaker faith? Maybe explain something along those lines.
Well, you'll have to wait until I publish my dissertation.
We're impatient, so go ahead.
This is actually what I'm writing about. It's about growth in the virtue of faith, according to St. Thomas.
Must plug.
Yes. Yeah. Question 5, Article 4. It's an untapped wonder.
Yeah, coming to JSTOR, a JSTOR near you, right?
Yeah.
One day.
I'll get one of those like self-published Amazon things. And
yeah, put it on Lulu.
there can be degrees of faith. And in question 5, Article 4, Thomas says, okay, faith can be more or less explicit, right? So the material object of faith, the stuff, like the truths distinctly that you have received from God, you can have them more or less clearly.
And the example I think of when I'm teaching about this is precisely myself or even my students, because I teach at a seminary. Yep. And I even tell these, God willing, future priests that they should have more explicit faith than probably, you know, the vast majority of their congregation, just simply because they've been given a great opportunity to grow in their faith in seminary formation. Is that an accurate way to put it?
Yeah, I think that's a great example. Thomas's prime example is the movement from the Old Covenant to the New Covenant. And that, or even within the Old Covenant, he says that, you know, the maiores, the prophets, the teachers, the patriarchs had an explicit faith even in the coming of Christ, while the ordinary people, they believed more implicitly through their rituals that God would, you know, that some savior was coming in some way. That's Thomas's classic, what he mostly has in mind in explicit, implicit, but we can apply to a bunch of other situations.
And you can imagine, you know, before a particular, even a minor prophet or whatever, you know, before the prophet versus after the prophet has told you what God says, there's like more to believe now, right?
Or those people who are not visibly part of God's covenant, and yet who, you know, in some hidden way have received saving grace, right? Thomas also notes Hebrews 11:6. You know, he who would come to God must, number one, believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. So like there's a bare minimum implicit faith that at least will acknowledge God's existence and God's providence. And that, you know, you could find examples of that even among the pagans, perhaps. So, but then in addition, so that's along the line of the material object of faith.
Yeah, I was about to say, because Father John, right, I mean, I'm sure you found this in your research, you can't reduce growth in faith to faith becoming more explicit. Is that
exactly
right?
Exactly. Otherwise, we would say that, you know, a theologian with a pontifical doctorate necessarily has more faith than, you know, the old man in the front pew at daily mass, who has obviously has more faith than I do, and he has lived that faith more than I have in so many ways.
We're talking about more in different ways.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. It's not just more
materially or kind of extensively.
It's the intensity of the virtue. It's its rootedness in the power of the soul. And that's in two ways, because again, faith is a virtue. Question four is inheres in both the intellect and the will. It's the intellect as moved by the will, and both powers of the soul are required for the act of faith. And so faith's deeper rootedness in the intellect is certainty. Thomas uses the word like faith can become more certain. And then in its rootedness in the will, it can become more devout.
Speak more about what do you mean by that? Or maybe Molly, if you want to say something, how is faith devout or more devout? I think some of our listeners might say, okay, that sounds nice, but what does it mean?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I want to let Father John kind of tackle that, but maybe just to say something philosophical by way of background that might help. When we talk about the virtues, they're qualities, not quantities. So we always tend to like reduce a quality to a quantity. So if you think of like height, you say like height itself is not a quantity, but we express it as like 6 feet, 5 feet, 1 kilometer, whatever it is. I guess that's not quite height. That would be distance. But it's not intrinsic.
That'd be really, really tall.
Yeah, exactly.
Space elevator.
But it's not intrinsically quantitative. So we should never think of faith as like, I'm going to make an act of faith and I'll get 5 grace points. And then I'll go up a level. It's a quality. It's much more of an organic understanding, at least in the Thomistic conception of it, just as a background. So let's not. So when we think of that, just to kind of maybe clear away a misconception. But I want to hear the way you think about devoutness, though, Father John. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. And Molly, that's a huge, hugely important point. And it's, you know, it's something we always have to keep in mind because we always do that.
Exactly.
Right? You know, that I'm just saying, I want more faith. Like I want more hamburgers,
Maybe video games have helped us to think that way with, you know, health points and everything else. Yeah, everything is quantified in the video game.
Life is so quantitative, even if you think of like a Fitbit or something, but that's not the way at least Thomas understands life of grace or faith.
Well, but I mean, this was... We were just having this conversation on the Slack the other day that, you know, we do in the Catholic spiritual tradition, we do speak of the three stages of, you know, the spiritual life, the beginners, the proficient, the perfect. you know, Saint Teresa has her seven mansions. Like, so this is not just a modern problem. This is
the
human intellect works.
But on the other hand, if you think of a plant or something, you could talk about stages of growth in a way that's not quantitative. So, I think my bigger concern is if you think, okay, if I just maybe read this many books or say the creed this many times, I'll get to a certain point automatically or to a certain level based on just the quantity of things I do, as opposed to actually growing in faith, which I think is kind of what you're getting to with devoutness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, certainty and devoutness is faith's rootedness in the intellect and the will. So the will is really the engine of faith, because it's the will that is actually always necessary for any act of faith, because we can't see what we believe. It's the will pursuing the good that God is, ultimately the good that is our supernatural end, right, through hope and charity. But even we won't talk about lifeless faith right now. That would be a whole other tangent. But so it's the in truly formed living faith, right? It's hope and charity that see, through faith the supernatural end, and then are in their pursuit of that end, prompt the intellect to make the act of ascent, and to continue to make the act of the ascent, and to make the act of the ascent more fervently, right? So it is the will that often is necessary to push the intellect through a lot of these tangles that it can get into, right? So, because the human mind on this earth is intrinsically beset by distractions, right? St. Peter, he's looking at Jesus, he's walking on water. He's all of a sudden pays attention to the wind and waves, and he realizes how implausible it would be that he would walk on water. And he starts to sink, right? So, all the stuff we believe, precisely in its unseenness, if you squint at it the wrong way, it will seem implausible. And so it's a very common experience to just be troubled in our faith. This doesn't seem true today. It doesn't seem true that God loves me because I'm suffering. Or, my Protestant friend sure knows a lot of Bible verses that I don't know. And so, any of these, or this material good that I really want to pursue seems a lot realer than heaven right now. And so, the more I give my heart to it, I guess the less real God seems, right? So those devotion is, again, that rootedness of faith in the will. In other words, the soul's filling itself with the supernatural end in such a way that it can kind of, again, not irrationally, but super rationally, sort of power through those distractions. And that's ultimately a growth in charity, causing a growth in faith, because the supernatural virtues are all, the theological virtues are always going to grow together. So the more intense pursuit of the end, causing the act of the intellect to become more fervent, more pure, more intense.
Yeah. So just to give you a scenario, Father John, to make sure I'm understanding this, say you have a cloistered nun who, you know, in her schedule, she doesn't really have time to study theology. So she prays, reads the Bible, has a very intense spiritual life. Through that, she'll be growing in faith because she has a deeper certainty in the things she knows that are true and a deeper capacity for devotion and insight into those truths, even though her faith is not necessarily becoming more explicit. So if you ask her, explain how the union of the two natures in Christ work, how does that work? And she maybe could not give like the answer sort of a teacher of theology would, but has that deeper devotion and insight that grows over time. Is that more or less what you're talking about?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. She's got the substance in such a way that like the details are not, don't matter as much to her pursuit of the end.
Yeah, because I was thinking of this because I've known some Dominicans who will teach the cloistered Dominican nuns. Yeah. And they say they'll, you know, give kind of, you know, the basic things they teach like master students or brothers. And some of the sisters, when they learn it, are like they're so, like, it's like they already knew it.
Yes.
It's like they already knew it, but to hear it explained is such a joy. And they already have such a deep insight to it that is more than just the explicitness of faith. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw you kind of make a, sorry, I know it's not a video podcast, but Father John was like, yeah.
I was pumping my fist. This is like absolutely right. And often like a deep, deep, deep insight into scripture.
Mm-hmm. Oh, exactly.
Like,
yes.
Like they understand the mysteries of the life of Christ just by hearing them. Exactly. Because why? Because they know him and he fills their field of vision far more than for the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. This is not to dog on explicitness of faith. To go back to sort of the discussion of apologetics. Anyone who's been given the responsibility or office of the church, whether that's being a catechist or, you know, teaching in a university, like you do, Brandon, or being a principal of a school, does have a greater obligation to know the truth in a more explicit way. And that's something that serves the church because you, to those who may be weaker in faith or don't have faith at all, you can explain more about God and remove some of those obstacles and prepare people to have faith. So it's definitely a good thing that, especially if you have any sort of role in the church, or even if you just like to help out at your parish, to know more about God, to study theology, to read, just even if it's just reading the catechism or reading more scripture, knowing more about God is always a good thing. So this is in no way to say like you shouldn't have more explicit faith. Of course not. But it's not the same as being, it's not the limit of what it means to be more devoted or the limit of what it means to be more faithful.
So this kind of brings up a practical question. How then does one go about growing in faith? You know, faith is a virtue, and often we talk about virtues, even among Catholics, we'll talk about them kind of predominantly as acquired virtues are talked about, where you repeat acts of the same species and develop the habit of that species. You know, so if the virtue is faith, then by repeated acts of faith, I, you know, deepen my virtue of faith, right? Yep. That seems to be the kind of predominant way that we talk about virtue. And there's a reason for that. It's in the tradition. It's in the philosophical and theological tradition. But is that how we grow in faith? We just have to like believe more often and as strongly as we can each time or something, you know, stronger than the time before, such that we just keep developing a disposition to more belief. Is that how we grow in faith?
Well, hold on. You just changed the question right at the very end there, with the word disposition. Okay. So right. Faith is not an acquired virtue. It's not something you can build for yourself. And with any of the infused virtues, they grow in the same way that they come, by a fresh infusion of God's grace. And so you cannot will yourself into a growth of charity. And I would say my tongue-in-cheek response to, like, how do I grow in faith? Well, just grow in charity. Right, because charity is the engine of, you know, the perfection of all the infused virtues. But there is an analog, right? The acquired virtues, the natural virtues, yes, that you are habituated to them through repeated action of the virtue. That does not work in the infused virtues because they are supernatural. But God does cooperate with our, you know, our own graced action. So repeated acts of faith, of charity, they dispose us for increase. They make it more fitting that God gives the gift of greater faith, of greater charity. So yeah, absolutely. You know, study is perhaps the number one way to grow in faith, just as long as you recognize you're not doing it for yourself. You are, precisely by marinating in God's word, doing the things that you can do to keep revealed truth, to keep divine truth, to keep first truth front and center in your intellect. And also precisely by doing your part in removing some of those obstacles that life or argument can put in the way, right? You are giving the opportunity, you're disposing yourself for the movement of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, and I think the key, I mean, I haven't looked into this nearly as deeply as Father John has, but thinking about growth in the infused virtues, it's very humbling because it's not something we can accomplish on our own. We're so dependent on God to increase those virtues in us. And the reality is that doesn't often happen on our timeline. Because growth in grace, at least in, I think, the way Thomas thinks about it, is organic, almost like a plant, where you have some periods where there's a lot of growth and other times when it just seems like, is this plant dead? What's going on? And, you know, I think it's a normal part of the Christian life that everyone has periods of time where there doesn't seem to be any visible growth. You know, hopefully the Lord is disposing us for a greater growth in grace later on. But it's not something, if we just check all the right boxes, automatically we'll get so many grace points and have so much growth in grace. It really all comes from God's initiative and God's will to save us. So we should have confidence that we will grow in grace, but there also has to be a humility where you realize that you can't totally control the process. Does that sound like what you found from your research, Father John?
Molly, that is a perfect paraphrase of question 24, article 6 of the
Spinoza. I mean, that's what I was going for. I mean, that's, yeah.
Yeah, on whether charity increases through every act of charity, you know, and he said, no, it's like a plant.
Yes, exactly.
So I mentioned heresy earlier, and maybe we can wrap up with this question, this discussion, because we're kind of coming towards time. But sins against faith. So we're talking about, you know, growing in faith and ways to kind of dispose oneself to grow in faith and what that might look like. But we also can sin against faith, right? And something that people often are aware of, you know, is thinking about how St. John Henry Newman describes, you know, doubt, that doubt is not simply having a question or a difficulty when it comes to one's faith. You know, I think he says something along the lines of 1,000 difficulties do not amount to a single doubt, right? So, But doubt is, a problem insofar as it's a sin against faith. And it's not just simply like, well, it fits into the category of sins against faith, but a sin against faith is really to act contrary to one's virtue of faith. That's what makes it a sin against faith. And so you really are acting against that virtue. And so if that's going to, if we have all these ways to grow in faith, I would presume that sins against faith are a great way. That's not the right word, but a strong way to kind of diminish one's faith. Is that accurate? And what are some of those sins we have to be aware of?
Well, now, the sins against faith that Aquinas kind of lists largely in the Secunda Secundae are not great ways to diminish one's faith. They are great ways to destroy one's faith.
Great.
Right. In other words,
thanks for the clarification.
Directly against faith is to not have faith anymore. So there are those. Heresy, apostasy, like if you really mean it, if you're doing it, arrogantly, if you're doing it explicitly, you are cutting your intellect off from the object of faith and replacing it with a different object. And so you actually need like conversion of the mind to recover from that. Now I would say though that more generally, and like he also talks about venial sins against faith, and he actually, it's in the question of the vices opposed to the gifts of knowledge and understanding. He talks about dullness of sense as a sin against those gifts, and by extension, a sin against faith. And really, that's any sin is going to cause that dullness of sense, especially sins of the flesh, right? Like those things that are going to most directly and most powerfully draw your focus low.
Faith is a drawing of the mind up, right? If you want to put it that way,
right? There is nothing that's going to make God seem less real than a sin against the sixth commandment. At least in that moment, at least before the moment of repentance, and God does give that grace.
And so, some ways you could say what I hear you saying is that sins against faith, or ways in which to sin against faith is not always, so to speak, directly to sin against faith as to renounce one's faith or to, but it's by, in some ways kind of, if you want to say, disposing oneself against faith, right? Or it's disposing oneself in a different direction than what faith points us in.
Yeah. And I think that, one of the things I try to do when someone comes to me and says, "Hey, Father, I'm is worried about that they're committing these sins against faith, or worried about that they're doubting," I try to say, "No, you're not." Right? And there's like, you are not, at least as far as I can tell, if you're just like struggling with the plausibility of this, that doesn't mean that you are doubting your faith. It doesn't mean you're actually explicitly, intentionally saying, "I don't know if God is true." You're noticing an aspect of its implausibility, and that's troubling you. And that itself is not like the rejection of your faith.
That's Newman's difficulty.
Exactly. It's not a doubt, it's a difficulty.
Yeah, doubt is more the kind of willful suspension of one's assent.
Exactly.
I willfully don't say yes to what God has revealed. Mm-hmm. And it's really kind of interior more than it is exterior. But there's definitely that willfulness that, I know this is what the church teaches, but I'm just going to say, I'm going to punt on that, I'm not going to say yes to it. I'm just going to let it sit there. And, I'd be better if I just pretended it didn't exist or something.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Molly, last thoughts on you know, growth in faith versus sins against faith. Anything else you want to mention on that?
Well, another thought that just may be helpful to think about is that the sort of core sin against faith is unbelief. And the two ways that can happen is just a sort of pure negation. You don't think anything about it, or an opposition. So that's kind of two ways that can work out. So, I mean, you probably have a little bit more pastoral experience with this, Father John, but I think there's a difference between someone who just is not really thinking about God and someone who's really decided to be against it. So if you do have a situation where maybe someone's Catholic, but, you know, the faith, you know, like the being God is really not on their mind, maybe there is room there to say, hey, you need watch some apologetics videos, read the scriptures, think a little bit more about God. And I think that's a far different situation than someone who's actively opposed to it, kind of like the counsel you give. But at the end of the day, I think it comes back to what we were talking about in the beginning, the formal object, that at the end of the day, it's all about God. And what faith does is elevate us so that we can know about God. And that's really the beginning and end of it all.
Well, great. I think we're kind of running against time, but I think we haven't talked about this, but we very well probably could have several episodes further unpacking how Thomas helps us to understand and think about faith. So I just want to ask the two of you, what are some of the other things that we have yet to address? Just to kind of whet the appetite. What are the questions that might still remain? What are the aspects about faith that we haven't quite gotten to yet?
The status of lifeless faith, you know, what faith looks like when it is not animated by charity, is a fascinating question. I think that we haven't really talked much about question two, the act of faith, and we could go a lot more into why explicit faith actually is pretty important, and also the Aquinas's appropriation of Augustine's kind of threefold understanding of the act of belief, you know, credere Deo, credere Deum, credere in Deum. Those would be my nominations.
Yeah, and then I think the sort of elephant in the room is, well, because we're the Sacra Doctrina Project, what about faith and Sacra Doctrina? There's so much we could talk about there, and there's a really also a very lively theological discussion to be had. So that would be kind of the first thing that comes to mind for me. But thanks so much for hosting this, Brandon. This is a really fun conversation.
Absolutely.
Talk all day.
Yep. Okay. Well, yeah, thanks, guys. Yeah, I agree. I had a great time.
Well, thanks, everyone, for joining us. It's been a pleasure to discuss faith and talk about it and help, rely on the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas to kind of make sense of what faith is and what faith is not and how we grow in faith and kind of some landmines to worry about or to be aware of when it comes to how we go through a life of faith and sins to watch out for. I think there's plenty that we could bring up again. And the one thing I'm really interested in is thinking about faith in terms of its relation to hope and charity. And I think the distinction between hope and faith is really important and often overlooked as well. So thanks for joining us for this episode of Sed Contra, a podcast of the Sacra Doctrina Project. And until next time, God bless you.